This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you find yourself weighed down by clutter, your own or someone else's, you're definitely not alone. We learn about why there's clutter in our lives, what we can actually do to prevent it. Now, if some new projections hold up, the state's going to have quite a bit of extra money on hand when the current budget cycle ends next year. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau had originally said we'd be looking at a roughly $0.9 billion surplus. Last week, it revised the estimate to $3.8 billion. So now, people are weighing in on what to do about it. Governor Evers said last week he wants to give every state resident some cash right now.
Under my plan, every Wisconsinite will be able to receive the full $150 for themselves and each of their dependents, meaning a family of four will receive $600 to help make ends meet. That means a little less stress and a little more wiggle room in a family budget and help those who really need it.
Evers also wants to commit $103 million for an income tax credit for caregivers, $139 million for higher education, and $610 million for public schools. Republicans say Evers' tax rebate amounts to an election year gimmick. They say they'd rather wait until the next budget and make some bigger changes to the state's overall tax code. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see done with the extra money? How do you feel about spending some of it on Wisconsin residents, caregivers, and education? Or is tax reform a better solution? Rainy day fund? Or is there some other need that should be addressed? Should it be spent now or later? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonah Ralston is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. He's coordinator of the university's public policy and administration program. His areas of interest include state politics. Jonah, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, Rob.
That's a big swing in our end of two-year budget projection. How did this happen? Where is this extra money coming from?
So part of the reason, of course, has to do with the federal injection of money. Many states right now are actually in a pretty good financial position as a result of that infusion of federal money. It also has to do with the health of the economy being a bit better than what was expected. And so that leads to higher tax revenues.
And of course, this isn't a $3.8 billion sitting in the bank right now. This is the latest projection on what's waiting for us in, what, a year and a half or so?
So these are projections, and it just so happens that, as you had mentioned at the top of the hour, half hour here, that the projections came in a bit higher, but, you know, to the tune of a few billion dollars than what was expected.
Let's look at first what Governor Evers is proposing to do with the money. We just heard him there talking about $150 per person in Wisconsin and then some spending on things like education and relief for caregivers. First of all, that sending checks to people, Governor Walker had done something similar in the last election here in Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on that as a policy idea?
I feel like there are two potential narratives here to this. So the one narrative, of course, is that this is a cynical election ploy, and that's in fact what the Democrats said in 2018 when Walker provided the child tax credit, which you're referring to, you know, the $100 that was given. And the other narrative would be that, you know, this is something that other states are also experiencing in terms of a surplus. And in a number of those instances, this is also being seen as what a number of them are going to do, which is provide some tax relief, provide money back to their citizens. I don't think that Evers has been employing that second narrative as much. He's been relying more on the fact that, you know, external events like the pandemic and such are warranting this money going back. But I do think that there are two potential narratives here, and there's probably some validity to both.
Of course, Governor Evers, to make this happen, would have to get support from Republicans in the legislature. They say probably not. I want to give a listen to Republican State Senator Roger Roth, who's been working on a bill that would eliminate the state income tax, which fits into some Republican plans of what to do with this surplus. He told WLUK-TV in Green Bay it's hard to compete with other states that have gotten rid of their income taxes.
Wisconsin has a demographic problem, people leaving the state. We've got to do things to incentivize individuals, millennials, families to come and live, grow, expand their families and their businesses in Wisconsin.
So Senator Roth and other Republicans talk about, hey, let's use this as a way to change our tax structure. First of all, what do you think of this idea of Wisconsin getting rid of the state income tax?
Well, we wouldn't be the first state to do it. There are, you know, a few states that have no income tax. But I do think that there is a cautionary tale here. Kansas, not too many years ago, chose to try to get rid of their income tax with Governor Brownback. And by all accounts, it pretty much was kind of a disaster. It did not go very well. And they had to end up rolling back a lot of the changes that had been made. And in fact, it got litigated all the way up to their state Supreme Court in terms of the actual decline was so substantial in education that it was brought up to the state Supreme Court as to whether or not they were meeting their requirements under the state constitution to provide education for their citizens. So I think it needs to be done in a proper way. And we probably would have to think about how to offset that tax revenue. So, you know, we're talking about $18 billion. This is a $3+ billion surplus. That's not going to, you know, meet the need there for the extra $15 billion. So you've got to figure out a way to still provide funding. What many states have done that don't have an income tax is usually they have higher sales taxes. So you can look at someplace like Tennessee. Our sales tax is between 5 and 5.5%, depending on the locality. In Tennessee, that usually ranges between like 8.5 and almost 10%.
And I know there are concerns about sales tax potentially being more regressive, having more of a burden for people with lower income. That's one argument I've heard against it anyway. Is there anything to that?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in Tennessee, they tax food even at 5%. And so, yes, there are some concerns about taxing consumption and how that can be regressive. Right now, the income tax in Wisconsin, unlike our neighboring state, Illinois, right, where it's more of a flat tax, in Wisconsin, it is definitely a progressive tax. And, you know, the higher income that you're earning, the more you're going to be paying in income tax back to the state. So in that case, it's a progressive tax system. If you move to, you know, higher sales taxes, yes, it could take up a larger portion of somebody's budget who's lower income.
Talking to Jonah Ralston from UW-Whitewater, looking at a projected budget surplus here in Wisconsin, higher than previously expected, and what, if anything, to do with it. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. You know, 100 years ago, Martin Pattison donated land for Pattison State Park. We celebrated a centennial a couple of years ago. The pandemic hit. I've spoken with Governor Evers. I've spoken with Representative Milroy, Representative Steinecke. I've spoken with Senator Janet Buley. We had a storm in 2018 causing millions of dollars in damage to the park, and it still hasn't been repaired. And when I spoke with the park superintendent, he said he had a number of projects submitted to the DNR, and they pulled out the funding on it. And now that we have a budget surplus, there's no excuse for people in Madison to neglect this state park. We deserve better in our state. Tourism is an important resource we have. And I've invited everyone to come up here to Pattison State Park and see for themselves. And talk with the superintendent has since resigned, so we're going to have to pick a new superintendent. But it's been 4 years for these repairs to be done, and we don't have the money? Well, now we do, and we need to get it done. And I mean all of us in Wisconsin need to start caring about this park.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jonah, Jeff making the case for a particular park, but the idea of using it for park cleanup, rebuilding, and more.
Yeah, in California, they're experiencing a budget surplus as well, and they directed a pretty substantial portion of the surplus to environmental causes and concerns. And so, you know, there is evidence from other states that they've looked in that direction. You know, the cautionary tale here, of course, is that anything that Evers would propose or wants to do would have to be approved by the legislature. This is not the federal COVID-19 relief money, which Evers had discretion over. This is state money, and the legislator ultimately will have the final say.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go now to State Senator Bob Wirch calling in from Kenosha. Senator Wirch, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In the last budget, the Republicans gave the homeless hit a real bad hit in the budget, meaning that Governor Evers put $13 million in to help the homeless. Not a big fund if you consider there's 72 counties in the state that all have homeless problems. By the time the Republican Joint Finance Committee got done with his budget, there was $1 million in to help the homeless. Now, by comparison, Minnesota spends $40 million to help the homeless. So I certainly like the $150 proposal by Governor Evers, but we should remember the homeless because the Republicans forgot about them in the last budget.
Senator Wirch, thanks for calling in. Joda, there we have it from a state legislator making the case to use some of the surplus for homeless relief.
Yeah, and I think a good point that was made is that, in fact, a number of Evers' proposals in this last budget had been stripped out and or reduced substantially. So if you look at what Evers had proposed in the last budget for education, for example, and what actually was funded, it was a fraction of what the governor had proposed. And so it certainly is the case that many of the governor's priorities, it has been difficult for him to get those passed, or at least to get funded at the amounts that he has wanted. And so I think that's going to remain a significant challenge in this last year of his term.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the state's projected budget surplus and what should be done with the projected $2.9 billion. Jonah Ralston stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator there of the university's Public Policy and Administration Program. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen with that extra money? Put it away in the rainy day fund. Send out a check to every state resident. Tax credit for caregivers. Overhaul the tax system in the state. Or fill in the blank. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about new revenue projections for the state. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau says Wisconsin will have a $3.8 billion surplus at the end of this budget cycle that ends next summer. Much more than expected. Governor Evers wants to give every state resident a $150 check, some tax credits for caregivers, and money for schools. Republicans say it's a chance to enact major tax reform in the next budget. Jonah Ralston stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator of the university's Public Policy and Administration Program. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Bowler. Mark, hi.
Yes. The senator from Kenosha kind of took the steam out of my point of helping the homeless, because a lot of us really don't need the $150 to get by. So the homeless, I think, would be the best place to put it. And the parks, of course. That's all.
Mark, thanks for the call. And I've seen some debate, Jonah, from people who do support the idea of direct payments. Policy debate between send a check to everybody versus what Mark said, focus the money on people who need it the most, maybe homeless people, maybe lower income people. What are the merits of everybody gets something or some people get more?
Right. And particularly in a more recessionary period, you would see a stronger call for some kind of stimulus, right? So that would be a payment directly to people. We're not really in that kind of environment now, and the economy has rebounded to a good extent. So I think there is less of a case perhaps now than there may have been just a year or two ago for the need of a direct payment. It's not to say that it can't be beneficial or that people wouldn't use them, particularly during a period of inflation right now when things are rising in price. And so, it could be useful for people. But yeah, those targeted kind of uses of the money, there is some merit to that. There could be some benefit to investing the state's money, if you will think of it that way, like a good return on investment for putting it into high need areas of the state. Again, I just think it's going to be very difficult, and it's probably why, partly why anyway, the governor has chosen the route he has. He's picked some priority areas that he really wants to put some money in terms of how he'd want to spend the surplus. But I think he was trying to appeal to Republicans who, in the last budget, had a strong preference for giving money back to Wisconsinites through tax reform. And so maybe he was trying to put it in something that would appeal to them. Unfortunately, the relationship between the governor and legislature is so acrimonious. It's difficult to see them finding any common ground. It's almost like they're making policy in spite of each other rather than because of one another at this point.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go next to Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see the money used in the university system to encourage our kids to stay in the state. I don't mind that people are leaving the state just for the sake of leaving. They might be retiring. But if they're leaving for jobs, we've got to have good quality jobs here in the state. I'd like to see some sort of a plan to maybe provide seed money for, say, 100 companies rather than one flat panel display company in down by Racine. Sorry, lost my train there. That turned out to be flat as far as employment. And then if I could wave my wand, I'd like to see interstate connection around the north side of Madison, north of Lake Mendota, to complete the loop around Madison.
Mike, thanks.
Alleviate the congestion.
Thanks for the call. Jonah, Mike has a long policy list there. The idea of investing, you know, the state has an agency that is supposed to help do some of the things that Mike talked about. What do you think of that idea of taking some of this money and using it for seed money, he said, for business creation?
Yeah, I think there were a number of good ideas put forward there. And there are a lot of positive externalities to this kind of spending. You know, that we can all benefit through, for example, investments in education. We can all benefit from investments in infrastructure. And of course, innovative use of the money are also welcome, like what was discussed in terms of seed money. I know, almost like the state being a capital venture fund here. But it's a great idea, right? A way to spur economic development, and particularly considering how hard hit many businesses were during the pandemic. This would be a nice boon potentially for entrepreneurs who were struggling to get things off the ground during the pandemic.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about a projected state budget surplus. Jonah Ralston is with us from UW-Whitewater. You can join in with your ideas of what to do with the money, if any, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I would say on a per capita basis, divvy the money up to the counties for road repair, because then everybody gets a chunk of it that doesn't go to one part of the state or the other. And I think if there's one thing that hopefully the governor and the Republicans and the legislature can agree on is roads are important statewide. So everybody wins, everybody gets a chunk of it. I say leave taxes alone, because you're just gonna have to pay, you know, down the road you're gonna have to raise them back up. So that's my two cents.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Jonah, I've heard concerns from people at the local government level that they feel like the state hasn't been sharing enough revenue with them for the kind of things Jimmy was talking about. What do you think of that idea of a one-time use of this money to build those local roads back up?
Certainly there has been a need for greater infrastructure funding in the state. So I think that the caller had some good ideas there in terms of using this to provide some of those needs that local governments have in terms of their current state of their roads. It's ever since the gas tax was it's no longer being indexed to inflation, which that happened under a previous Democratic governor with a Republican legislature. Kind of, again, the cautionary tale of tax reform here, right? It was a way seen as, you know, reducing tax burden on Wisconsinites. But at the same time, you know, a decade later, it created a pretty significant transportation funding shortfall, which has yet to be addressed fully. And so, yes, that could be one avenue to use this money, would be for infrastructure. And of course, it would piggyback on some of the federal investment in infrastructure that's going to be occurring.
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. Carter joins us now in Cambridge. Carter, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the call. I'm enjoying listening to you gentlemen talk. I agree with what Evers wants to do with the money. And as far as what the senator said about Minnesota, there's a little comment I'd like to make about our sister state over there. It's 6 years ago, they proposed a fair tax law. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. The Republicans were fighting it, saying businesses were going to leave. And after they passed it, got it through, the following year and the year after, the politicians were fighting over what to do with the leftover budget from the previous years.
Carter, thanks a lot for the call. Jonah, something like that, a change in tax laws, and I think it was aimed at bringing more revenue, especially for wealthier people in Minnesota, seems like a tall order with the Republican lawmakers here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that basically any of the tax increases or changes that Evers had proposed in the last budgetary cycle were shot down pretty quickly by the Republican legislature. They certainly are interested in, as they are calling it, you know, once in a generation tax reform. My guess is, though, they're not interested in that reform with Governor Evers. So what they're hoping is that there will be a change in the governorship and that they'll have a Republican governor that they can work with to, you know, put into place that reform.
Thanks for that call. And Jonah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jonah Ralston, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator there of the university's Public Policy and Administration Program. We talked to him today about Wisconsin's $2.9 billion projected budget surplus and what Governor Evers and state Republicans say they want to do with the money. Thanks for all of your calls. A lot of ideas out there. You can keep them coming. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page to check out the latest reporting on these issues, or at WPR.org. You can always tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Now, clutter is big business in the United States. There are services that help us clean up and get organized, or to deal with all our possessions after we leave them behind. And it's big in pop culture, from shows like Tidying Up with Marie Kondo that make the case for getting rid of things that don't spark joy, to shows like Hoarders that look at clutter when it's taken to the extreme. But those all deal with clutter that we already have. Our next guest says we need to look at the causes of clutter and what leads us to get so many things in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with clutter and stuff? Do you have a horror story to share, your own, or maybe cleaning up for a relative, a success story? Did you change your attitude about buying stuff to have less clutter in the first place? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. Her latest book is called Clutter, An Untidy History. Jen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, you open the book with a story about your mother and going through her home and her stuff. Can you talk about what you went through and why that inspired you to seek out more of the history of clutter?
Sure. Well, like a lot of us, I found myself actually very suddenly in the position of having to clean out my mother's house after she had a mental and physical breakdown. It really was, she went from overnight living in her house that she'd been in for 50 years to not being able to be there at all. It just wasn't safe. So it felt to me as an only child to go in and try to make some sense of everything that she had. You know, I had to deal with her papers, her finances, all the medical care, but then I had this house full of stuff. And I was shocked and overwhelmed by how much stuff my mother had managed to accumulate in all that time. I knew she was not a minimalist, but I didn't realize, until I actually had to deal with everything in there, just how much she had. And that got me interested sort of as a survival mechanism in trying to understand what was happening and how my mother, and as it turns out, so many other people, wound up in this really, really difficult situation.
And you dug back into history and you find we're not alone in the United States with clutter and having lots of stuff. But you kind of trace the history here in the U.S. back to Victorian England, when we start to have a different relationship with being able to buy lots of stuff and wanting lots of things. What kind of things did you find out?
Oh, it was fascinating. I could have written multiple books on just on the Victorians alone. I was hoping I could find a starting point for clutter, like the historical moment when clutter was born. And I couldn't really trace the moment, but there was so much in the Victorian era that resonated for me as a 21st century American, the kind of love of things and the love of having nicely furnished houses and all the stuff we can buy and the message that we get to, you know, that we should be buying things, should be buying more. The Victorians would have been very familiar with all of that. When you look at the Industrial Revolution and, you know, the ability to make more things more quickly and ship them to people, with the rise of cities, with department stores, all these things kind of started to coalesce as I was reading and looking around for me in the Victorian era. And you think about the Crystal Palace, the famous glass, huge glass showcase, basically, of the London Exhibition in 1851. That really became a touchstone for me for this modern phenomenon of clutter. And I really felt it was very, very much an important starting point for that.
I mentioned earlier the TV show Hoarders. There are others that look at, you know, when collecting stuff really goes to an extreme. A big point in your book, though, is those shows sometimes treat the hoarder as this sort of individual pathology. You kind of see it, correct me if I'm wrong, you see it as a symptom of a wider attitude toward consumerism and our desire to have and keep stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, of course, personal choice and personal habits and sometimes mental challenges can really contribute to this problem. But, you know, from the minute we're born, we are steeped in this culture of buy, buy, buy. You think about if you've ever been to a baby shower or anything, really anything you do in modern life involves the message that you should buy something. And that's what you should be doing as a good consumer and all that. And it's very hard for individuals to escape the power of that message. As I said, it starts when we're kids, and we're surrounded by advertising and by big box stores and now online, e-commerce, Amazon. It's so easy to buy, and as I saw with my mother, I think she got trapped in this web of consumerism, and once you're stuck in it, it can be very, very hard for people to get out of it just through force of individual will alone.
Talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's a lot of clutter in your life? What leads you to buy stuff, bring you into your home? What challenges do you have when it comes to getting rid of stuff? Do you know someone who you've seen it go pretty far with bordering on hoarding things? What changed? Was there something that made them change their ways? Call in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, you just mentioned sort of the emotional connection we have with things. And I'm not a hoarder. I kind of go back and forth. I just purged a bunch of kids' drawings from their little. And I go back and forth between, there's a smudge on this paper that a kid might have made. Got to keep it forever, to this ruthless paring down. But I get the emotional investment in a thing. There's a memory connected with why we have it in the first place that I can understand people being reluctant to let go of. Talk about the emotions at the center of this.
Oh, that's really at the heart of it. That is what makes it, I think, so hard for so many of us to get rid of things, because we do have personal connections. And, you know, if grandma gave you something, mm-hmm. or the little thing you brought back from the sea, you know, your beach trip with the kids, and you feel like you're throwing away the vacation if you throw away the object. It's really hard. And if every object or many of them have that kind of some kind of emotional baggage with them, no wonder it's hard to get rid of them. I mean, if you have to stop and process all those feelings, those memories, it's overwhelming. And it's easy, again, since we are so, you know, a society that really does value things, we sometimes conflate the thing with the person or the memory, and it's very hard to kind of extricate yourself from that. The kids' artwork, all, you know, everything your child ever touched is valuable or feels like it, but it's hard to actually sort of get yourself to do the process of sorting and deciding what's really important, what's enough, and what's too much.
A lot of our efforts, and a lot, I think, businesses make money off of this, they go toward the back end. We have the clutter. We have the stuff. How do we organize it? How do we sort it? How do we purge it? Whatever. What kind of things are you thinking about when it comes to the front end, whether we bring a thing into our house in the first place and how we curate it before it becomes cluttered in the first place?
That's the thing. If you can head it off at the pass, that's the way to go. It's very hard because you know, we're in a society that gives us freebies and sends, you know, everything comes in a bag and a package. And you go to if you go on to a hotel, you come home with all these little shampoos and conditioners, you know, it's free. Why not? Maybe it'll be useful. And it's so, but you really have to take that early step of saying, do I really want this? Do I really need it? You know, is it just going to take up space in my medicine cabinet or my closet or my kitchen cupboard? All those sauce packets that you get, if you get takeout food. And when you start looking for opportunities to say no to things, you realize there are a lot of them, and it doesn't seem like it would make that much of a difference, but over time it really does. And it's, you know, saves you time, saves you the energy of having to try to figure out what you're going to do with it down the road. Bigger purchases too. Do you really need more clothes? You know, shop your closet first. There are things you can do that really will help address the clutter problem and be more economical and also just better for the environment and society in general.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Wazaki. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am an artist. My husband sort of considers me a hoarder. I mean, he can get through my house and my dishes are clean, but I paint and I quilt and I draw and I sew and I have canning stuff I've got stuff. I've probably got 5-6 times what the average person has, but it's because I do all of these things. I have trouble finding homes for things, you know, permanent places to put them, and I have difficulty with storage. But I worry. I'm getting a little bit older, and I worry about something happening to me, and then what's whoever's left taking care of it going to do with all of it?
Have you thought, Lisa, or have you looked for ways to curate a purge? And I know it might be hard, but deciding that some stuff has to go, even if it doesn't find a home?
Yes, I've actually pared down some of the things that I've done. Like, for instance, I can do probably 100 different crafts, but I've decided that, you know, maybe 5 of them are what I'm really interested in, and I've tried to let the rest of it go. But I have to bring myself back to that regularly, because my set point is to try to do everything.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Jennifer, that reminds me, this is the thing where somebody we might look at and say is a hoarder, which we'll talk about that word in a bit, but also they might be an artist. There's a lot more to their story than that, as we just heard from Lisa.
Sure, absolutely. No, that really resonates with me. And, you know, if you're using your things and appreciating them, they're not really clutter, I don't think. I mean, clutter is chaotic. It's messy. It's kind of deprives it makes the things not really useful in the way they are. And it sounds like for someone like Lisa, who's actively creating and using things, you know, maybe there's sort of a, she can sort of think of her excess as, there might be other people out there who could use things, or she could kind of help circulate things. I don't know. I think there are some ways to make it less, make the amount of stuff seem less overwhelming. And if you're thinking about it in the first place, that's huge. That is, I think it really sets someone who can handle their stuff apart from people who are just lost entirely in all their stuff.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're talking to writer Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about clutter in your life, your relationship with your stuff, your kid's stuff, your parents' stuff, maybe, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with writer and editor Jennifer Howard about her latest book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Marcus on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Rob. So my great aunt and uncle used to have a little wooden plaque in their house that said creative clutter is far superior to idle neatness, and I completely agree. As for what the guest was talking about before with or you were saying with kids' pictures and stuff from the beach and whatever else, I like to do art in my free time. And so I started taking with my kids, we'll sit down and go through their pictures from school and whatever else. And then some of the stuff we may have picked up, rocks or shells or whatever at the beach. And then we try to either get a board or a shoebox or something, make some sort of diorama or some sort of other creation out of pictures that they pick. So that way they're having to kind of choose and go through, like, why they like this one or why I like this one. And then we kind of create something new. So then you add an extra layer of memory on top of it. And it's a great way to use up some of that stuff.
Interesting, Marcus. Thanks so much. What it's kind of shopping at home, Jennifer, and creatively repurposing the stuff that's around instead of just, storing it somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. I mean, that really shows you that objects can have a meaningful role in your life, and you know, there's an active choice there too. And it gets I love that Marcus is getting his children to think too about what matters to them and what their, you know, that how they can kind of work their important things into their lives instead of just having stuff pile up around them and not be appreciated. I think that's great.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that. Could use that probably 15 years ago. We'll go next to Jamie in Middleton. Jamie, hi.
Hi, this is Jamie. I was just speaking to my parents are moving out of the house we grew up in, and so they've been there for 30 years, and their professions are a former art teacher and construction worker, and so with those careers come a lot of stuff. So we're finding it tough to get rid of and want to be mindful of how to recycle and not waste, but 30 years can be quite the accumulation.
Yeah. And now, Jamie, is there a sense that, hey, some of this stuff, I mean, construction worker, art teacher, they're going to have stuff that might be useful to somebody? Is that part of the stumbling block that they want to make sure they're not wasting something that somebody can make use of?
Yes. And obviously, it's a passion of both of theirs. And a lot of heart goes into the work. So you know what things are worth and all the different ideas you have with it. So yeah, definitely want to recycle and reuse and give it to someone else who might find use, but quite the process if it's not something you kind of keep up with and sort through as you go.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing that. This is something, Jennifer, that a lot of people have been through, you to some extent with your mom's stuff. Like, some of this is going to end up in landfill, but maybe some of this has sentimental value for somebody. Waste not, want not. Maybe somebody could use this stuff. How much could that lead to keeping the clutter?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. People think, well, it's, you know, it's perfectly good. I don't want to throw it out, you know, and it could be useful someday. And the truth is, most of the time, it's not going to be useful. And if you really need that thing, you can probably borrow it or get it again. But I, you know, the idea is much easier to let go of things if you can rehome them and you know that you're going to, that they're going to be used. They're not going to wind up in a landfill, especially when, as Lisa was describing, there are things that, you know, have to do with how you spend a lot of your life, your career, your family. And it takes a lot of work to do that kind of the rehoming and donating. But if, especially living at a family house and try to get help your parents deal with all of their things, it probably is worth the time if you can take the time, even though it is harder. You don't want to just pull up a dumpster and, you know, throw it all away. It's much easier to try to, ultimately, it's more emotionally satisfying to let it go when you know it's going to have another life.
Thanks again for that call. Good luck to your parents as they make those decisions. We are talking to Jennifer Howard about her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Kewaskum. Dave, hi.
Hey, yeah, so like that caller Lisa before, my dad was an artist growing up, so he always collected a bunch of what people call junk, you know, plastic tubes, stuff like that. And they always sort of rode that line of being hoarders. And then one day, between health issues and they got hold of that Marie Kondo book, they just went through and threw out everything. And they were very satisfied. They're very happy with where they are right now. But in the process, they threw out a lot of, you know, family heirlooms, stuff that was significant to the family. And we never really got an opportunity to go through it with them and point out what we would like to keep. And that sort of left an open wound in the family.
Wow. Dave, thanks for sharing that. I mean, did you come to terms with that? Did you talk to them about that, find out other ways to keep memories without the objects?
Not really. I mean, we managed to salvage some family photos, but that's still sort of an ongoing thing.
Wow. Dave, thank you for sharing that. Jennifer, maybe this is another extreme. I don't know. Some people did want the stuff that was gotten rid of here.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a balance. You know, I think especially when you're, it's not just your stuff, but it's your family history, which especially with a family house, you know, and your parents have, I just went through all my elementary school papers that my parents had saved. And, you know, at least I got to make the decisions about that and got to relive some of the highs and lows of my, you know, my childhood. And I regret, one thing I really regret with my mother is that I didn't have a chance to sit down and hear her stories about her stuff. You know, I was flying in the dark, basically, when it came to what was important to her or who this person in this photograph was. And it's a loss, you know, as the caller was just describing, it's almost like everything got taken away from you in a fire or a flood. You know, to have no say in how your history, what parts of your history you get to save. That's really traumatic. And ideally, if you have relatives who are downsizing, they will give you a chance to, you know, hear their stories and help you, or you maybe let you help them make some choices about what to say and what might be meaningful to future generations. Because once that stuff is gone, it's gone.
Thanks, Dave, for sharing that with us. Sherry joins us now in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi. My husband and I taught internationally for 32 years. And we traveled, and everywhere we went, we'd collect things. And then we'd come home, and we'd store them away, and then we'd go to another location. And so now that we've retired, we've unpacked all this stuff, and we have a very cluttered house with stuff, beer steins, paintings from China, paper cuts, teapots, Saudi Arabian coffee pots, porcelain, and beer steins, and it goes on and on and on. And I'm trying to, and our children aren't interested. And so I'm trying to figure out where I could have these things settled, because it's not like something you would get at a thrift store, I don't think. Of course, my treasures. And so I would love to know where I could actually take some of the stuff, because some of it is antiquities.
Sherry, thanks for the call. And this has got to be a common question. I bet a lot of people bring it up to you, Jennifer. This stuff is too good to just give away, but I don't know what to do with it.
Oh, it's so common, especially as you know, with a lot of family furniture and things like that. And it sounds like the caller has a lot of interesting stuff collected from around the world. I mean, honestly, it's good to be realistic about whether people really want to pay money for your things if you don't have family members who want them. A lot of people do have success with estate sales, and you don't have to die to have an estate sale. You can have a downsizing sale, and there are companies that will actually work with you, and they do take a percentage of the profits, but they can come in and they you know, kind of look at what you have and put prices on it and advertise the sale. That could be potentially a useful option in that case. But then sometimes you just have to let it go too, and to know when it's too much effort to try to sell it, and it's better to just find it a new home.
Well, thanks for all of your calls today. And Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. And I loved all the calls. So many good stories.
Yeah. Jennifer Howard is a Washington, D.C.-based writer and editor. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called Clutter, An Untidy History. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts on clutter in your own life or that of people you know. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.